Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Ian Manuel was sentenced to life in prison without parole for a crime he committed at the age of 13. He had just finished the seventh grade. He spent 18 of his 26 years behind bars in solitary confinement. He has a new memoir out about it. It's called My Time Will Come, a memoir of crime, punishment, hope, and redemption. And he joins us now. Ian, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me, Meghna.
I wonder if you might first describe one of the cells that you spent all those years in solitary in. How many paces did it take you to walk across the cell?
Thank you for asking that question. I'm glad you said one of the cells, because I was in so many different cells over the course of my 26 years. But the cell that I spent the majority of my time in, it's a short cell, as I describe in My Time Will Come. It's a short, small cell with about 5 to 9 steps with a size 9.5 shoe from the back wall to the front door. There's a steel bunk with a thin mattress that has been stained from other inmates' urine. And there's some thin sheets. There's a steel toilet, a steel sink. There's a front door with a rectangle size window that if you're caught looking out of when a female staff member is on the way, you're gassed with high powered chemical agents. And there's a light that is kept on for mostly 16 hours a day, burning in your eyes. It's probably the reason I wear reading glasses to this day.
Yeah. No window.
Yes. No. The back window is covered up so you can't see out of it, you know, and it intensifies in the summer. It intensifies the heat in the cell.
Okay. And what did it sound like? What did you hear when you were inside that cell for the years that you were in cells like that?
Various sounds. That's a great question. Sometimes there was the sounds of inmates playing chess, calling out chess numbers. The number 13 to 29 resounds in my mind because that's a chess move where the pawn is pushed out in front. Inmates playing chess to break up the monotony of the day. There's arguments between the fellow prisoners just to pass their times, argument about things that they did in society, about their favorite sports team, about their favorite singers and actors, who could sing the best, who could rap the best. There's an officer screaming, "Female staff on the wing, get off the door." There's the nurse on the wing. There's the sounds of a flattened toothpaste tube sliding across the floor as you fish for a magazine or something from another inmate so you could try to read it. And if you're caught fishing for a magazine or with this other inmate's magazine, your time in solitary confinement is extended for an additional 6 months.
Huh. And how many hours a day were you in this cell?
So it varies, because I was in solitary confinement before they changed the rules.
Okay.
when they gave us very little outside activity. So a lot of people think you have 23 hours in and 1 hour out. Actually, we were locked down 24 hours a day, not 7 days a week. Every now and then they let us out for recreation for 2 hours once a week. But then the inmates in prison sued the Department of Corrections for the cruel and unusual way that we were being treated. So they started giving us three times out of our cell a week for 2 hours each. So Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. But they don't only have so many rec cages. They call them dog cages that they put you in to take you outside and with a dip bar, individual cages, and a dip bar and a pull-up bar. but they only have so many cages. So they would deliberately deny people access to the rec yard. And you have to be up at 5 a.m. in the morning, naked except your boxers, with your clothes in your hand, so they can write a sign on your door that you were prepared. Your cell has to be spotless. If they find a piece of paper on the floor, you're denied recreation. If they flip your mattress back and your bed is and your sheets are tied, you're denied access to the rec yard. It's a really cruel and unusual way that people are treated in solitary confinement in Florida.
Now, we'll talk in a few minutes about the crime that landed you in prison. We'll talk about that in detail, because that in and of itself and the journey that you've taken with the woman who you shot is a tremendous story. Yes. But Ian, I want to ask you, people oftentimes presume that when an incarcerated person is put into solitary confinement, that they had done something to be separated. They had done something, right, to be separated right from the general population. But you were barely into your teenage years. Can you tell us why you were first put into solitary?
Yes, I can tell you why I was first put into solitary. Initially, on my first day in prison, I was placed in solitary confinement based on my age and how small I was. They couldn't even find clothes to fit me. I remember showing up to the reception center at Lake Butler, Florida, and the officer saying, "How old are you?" And I said, 14, because I had just turned 14 that March, and this was May of 91. And they said, "Call Kay Wayne. We got another one of those pop-eyed kids down here for him." And then they placed me in solitary confinement. Then I was punished because I didn't want to clean my cell on the Sabbath day. I was slapped and beat up by a notorious captain at Lake Butler by the name of Captain Young. And they placed me in a deeper form of solitary where there's a cell bars and a door, and they close the door and you can't even see out. There's no light. I remember laying on that floor that night, waking up, as I describe in my book, My Time Will Come, with cockroaches crawling over my body. And I just couldn't believe how far I had fell from just being a little kid at my mom's house to having cockroaches crawling on my body in solitary confinement. Hmm. Well, that only lasted for 3 weeks. And then I was placed in open population adult prison at Appalachian Correctional Institution. And I was given all the responsibilities of an adult, except I was still a child. So I behaved as a child. Even the Bible says, when I thought as a child, I behaved as a child. Well, I'd walk in the grass when I was supposed to be walking on the sidewalk. The officers would yell at me. I'd yell back. I was in places I wasn't supposed to be, like a typical teenager. I'd be in another dormitory that I wasn't assigned to. And all those things caused me to accumulate disciplinary reports. And so the prison deemed me a management problem for these minor disciplinary infractions. And at the age of 15, I was placed in long-term solitary confinement in November 1992 when George H.W. Bush was president. And I wasn't released from solitary until November 2010, so 18 consecutive years.
And just to be clear, Ian, that first time you went into solitary was because of your small size, and they were doing it for your protection, supposedly?
Yeah, they was doing me a favor. A favor that I didn't want. I can tell you that. No one wants to have their freedom stripped from them in the way that it was when I first went to prison, or even afterwards.
Hmm. Now, you're an activist and a poet. And some of the poetry is featured in your book, My Time Will Come. I'm wondering if you could read one of them to us now, Uncried Tears. Could you do that?
Yeah, sure. And Uncried Tears. Imagine teardrops left uncried from pain trapped inside, waiting to escape through the windows of your eyes. Why won't you let us out? The tears question the conscience. Relinquish your fears and doubts and heal yourself in the process. The conscience told the tears, "I know you really want me to cry, but if I release you from bondage, in gaining your freedom, you die." The tears gave it some thought. before giving the conscience an answer. If crying brings you to triumph, then dying's not such a disaster.
That's Ian Manuel and his poem, Uncried Tears. It's featured in his new memoir, My Time Will Come, a memoir of crime, punishment, hope, and redemption. Ian Manuel spent 18 years in solitary confinement of 26 years of his imprisonment. He was released in 2016. 18 total years in solitary confinement. Ian, did you ever feel like it was... like you were going to lose your mind?
No. Okay. I had a secret. Being a child helped me, actually, because my brain wasn't fully developed, so I constantly dive within the depths of my imagination to survive. I liken it to a fish. You know, think of a fish that's underwater, and even fish come up for air every now and then, that little quick dip of air. I want you to imagine air and oxygen as being reality. And people in solitary confinement constantly dive within the depths of their imagination to survive. The only difference is the people that go crazy never come up for that breath of fresh air from reality, for reality, you know? With me, I always took that dip of fresh air, and I had a childlike imagination, and it's where I lived at. You know, I'd imagine myself, when you're powerless, you constantly fantasize about being powerful. And I used to fantasize of being... out in society, giving speeches, writing a memoir, having a movie about my life, being in a position of power to go to the legislature to change what was going on in the prison system because I've experienced it firsthand. Talking to Congress about changing the laws, out helping people get elected that actually care about the way the prison system is being ran. Those were all the fantasies I had in my mind. And I walked back and forth in my cell and I just... challenge myself, man, to constantly focus on that I wouldn't die in prison, that I'd get out one day.
Well, Ian Manuel's new book is called My Time Will Come. He did get out. He's telling his story, and we're going to hear a lot more of it when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking with Ian Manuel. His new memoir is My Time Will Come, a memoir of crime, punishment, hope, and redemption. He committed a gun crime at the age of 13 in 1990. He served 26 years behind bars. 18 of those years were in solitary confinement. Now, at the time that Ian Manuel was serving his prison sentence, there were only 8 people in the world who were serving life without parole for crimes committed at the age of 13. All 8 of them were in the United States, and only 2 of them were for non-homicide crimes, and Ian Manuel was one of them. Now, Ian, I wonder, again, I mentioned in the previous segment that you're an activist and a poet, and I want to talk a little bit about the crime that landed you behind bars. And in order to do that, can you read us your poem, Take It Back?
Yes, and I'd just like to preface that by saying the inspiration behind this poem was Nas has a song, the rapper Nas has a song called Rewind. Mm-hmm. And I used to challenge myself in solitary confinement to rewrite the greatest poets and rappers of our time, saying that if I didn't have what it takes to rewrite their stuff, then I couldn't be successful. These were the things that helped me break up the monotony of the day. And so Take It Back says, her mouth opens as she inhales her scream. The bullets are reloaded because the trigger was never squeezed. We're back at the start when we first asked for change, and her face is still the same because she never felt that pain. He isn't on his knees looking me in my eyes like I'm the last thing he'll see for the first and final time. The song Self-Destruction isn't resounding in my mind. We're just standing at the scene before it became a crime. I'm back in Central Park at that two-story apartment building, never knowing that where I'm going would make this true story unforgettable. If I could see into the future, sitting on that porch on India when my co-defendant came to visit, I'd have chose to stay with Lydia. July 27th, an unpleasant day in history. If I could ever take it back, it would be a total different memory.
It's Ian Manuel. His poem is Take It Back. So can you tell us what happened on that day when you shot Debbie Bagrie? You were just 13. What happened?
Yeah, I was. I remember it like it was yesterday, July 27th, 1990, around afternoon time. I was sitting on the porch with my then girlfriend at 13, and I kept trying to talk her to go upstairs with me. She wouldn't. And my friend came and tried to get me to go to the game room, and I turned him down and said, I'm chilling with my girl. And then another friend came and asked me that I want to go somewhere else. I turned him down. Then my another friend came with a gun. And by this time, I was just tired and frustrated. And he said, Ian, I have a gun. Let's go downtown and do some robbing. And I said, man, might as well. And in my childlike imagination, I was imagining my girlfriend would tell me, no, come back. No, don't go. But she didn't. And I left. And we went downtown and with three other, it was a total of four of us. And we went downtown looking for people to rob. And I was the youngest, but I was given the gun and I was encouraged to commit these robberies, but they was trying to rob people in the open. And I kept turning them down. So finally, all of us sat down on the curb and the oldest guy said, if you're scared, give the gun to somebody else. So I passed the gun off to my friend and he passed the gun to his cousin and he passed the gun to the oldest guy. And then we passing this gun around like a hot potato and it ends up back in my hand. And my friend says, Ian's not scared. And we make a pact that the next people that we come up to, no matter if it's in the open or not, the crime is going to happen. And we approach this couple sitting on this car, standing in front of this red car, I never forget. And the oldest guy asked for change. And I thought I heard somebody say, yeah, we got change. And I pulled the gun out. And the lady screamed, and next thing I know, when she screamed, I fired, and everything just happened so fast. It was a blur from that point on. Some more shots were fired. My friends began searching the man for money, and I turned back and I ran back towards my neighborhood, and I turned around and asked the guy who was searching the man, did he have any money? And he said he didn't have one dime on him. Yet and still, the man said he gave me money. So that's how I received the life sentence for a robbery that I didn't commit, but I did, you know, in essence, commit a crime that night. It just wasn't armed robbery.
Yeah. So you ended up getting sentenced to life in prison without parole, right?
Yeah. I'll never forget that the judge looked at me and said, to preface that, my lawyer had me plead guilty, an open plea of guilt, throw myself at the mercy of the court. And I told him that I did not want to plead guilty. He said, Ian, you're only going to get 15 years. I've talked to the judge. I don't know about you, but telling a 13-year-old child that you're going to get 15 years, that in and of itself sounds like a life sentence. Mm-hmm. And the judge looked at me when it was time to be sentenced, and he said, Mr. Manuel, that was a statement made earlier today in this courtroom about giving you a second chance. But sometimes there are no second chances. So for the crime of attempted murder, I sentence you to life. For the other crime of attempted murder, I sentence you to life. For the crime of attempted armed robbery, I sentence you to 15 years. These sentences are to run concurrent. And for the crime of armed robbery, I sentence you to life probation. And life probation is being imposed in case the Department of Corrections should, for whatever reason, ever release you. And this sentence is, and this courtroom is adjourned. Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the statements that were made in court? I mean, because Debbie Bagri, the woman that you shot, she made a statement in court.
Yeah, she made a statement. And, you know, as I described in my memoir, My Time Will Come, Debbie looked over and saw me laughing. And she thought I was laughing and not taking the courtroom's procedure seriously. I didn't know that in the courtroom, everyone, there's a bunch of characters and everyone has a role to play. I was 13 and 14 years old. I was, they separate the juveniles and put us in the jury box. And a kid next to me said something funny and I laughed. Debbie saw me laughing and took that to heart and told the judge that Ian doesn't take this serious. So if he doesn't care what happened to him, himself, I don't care either. And the judge took her statement as if, you know, but he pretty much had his mind made up, but he took her statement as if that she was wanting me to be sentenced harshly, which she wasn't. She didn't want me to be sentenced harshly. Mm-hmm. And I was sentenced to the rest of my life in prison.
You know, there's two really big stories wrapped up in your life. One of them is the way the criminal justice system in the United States treats juveniles and how exceedingly rare it is in the cruel way that the criminal justice system in this country can treat juveniles.
Yes.
The other is what brought you to that point, that day in July in 1990, where, as you say, you shot a woman. You were 13.
Yes.
I mean, you in your book, My Time Will Come, you talk about how you started committing crimes with weapons even earlier than that, at 11. I mean, you were just a baby. Child isn't even the right word in my mind. I mean, you were just a baby, an 11-year-old, when this got started in your life. You know, there's plenty of other 11, 12, 13-year-olds who don't end up shooting somebody. So can you tell me what got you to that point where, you know, you had a weapon and that July day happened?
Yeah, because I wasn't raised like that. My grandmother didn't raise me like that. My mom didn't raise me like that. But maybe it's a couple things, a few factors come to mind. It's my environment, because when I was with my friend, the president of the YMCA's, Bob Gilbertson, I wasn't committing those crimes when he introduced me to middle-class America. But hurt people hurt people. And I was hurting. I was in pain. I had been abused by my mother. I had been abused by my brother. And also I was under the influence of peer pressure. We cannot magnify enough the power of peer groups to influence our decisions in life. And yes, I was a baby when I committed my first crime at 11, walking home from school, committing armed robberies with a gun somebody else had brought to a fight. I was still a teenager when I shot somebody. I think, you know, prison saved my life, because I was on a road to destruction. Again, the song Self-Destruction was playing in my mind the night I shot Debbie. And and it stopped me in my tracks from, you know, even doing something even worse. And so I just feel like environment plays a huge role, despite what the judge said that night, and peer pressure as well.
I wonder if you write about it in the book, so would you mind telling us a little bit bit more about, for example, like the way your mother treated you?
Yeah, my mother was, she loved me in her own special way. But the thing she said to me that I thought was normal was not normal things to tell a child. Like, I wish you, I found you on the doorstep. She tell me to go outside and play. And I look out the window and say, Mom, there's nobody to play with. And she'd say things like, if God wanted you to have somebody to play with, Ian, I would have had twins. You were born by yourself. And so those were the bad things that she did. And she tell me about my skin color, about how black I was, which caused me to take bleach baths to try to, you know, lighten my skin tone as a child so I could, my mother could have a son that she would be proud of and love. But she'd also do other things, like force me to stay on the front porch and learn to commit the Lord's Prayer to memory before I went off into the Boys and Girls Club. She tell me, Ian, you're brilliant. No matter what, don't never let them take your mind. And she'd say these things when I was a child, but I call on them when I was in solitary confinement to help me get through. Like, Ian, you're brilliant. Don't never let them take your mind, no matter what. And so it was a double-edged sword with my mom and her love.
Mm. You just said a minute ago that you think prison saved your life, but of course no one wants that to be the way their life is saved. 26 years, 18 years in solitary. I mean, no one knows your life better than you. And I'm wondering now, looking back, what do you think before you were 13 would have needed to be different so that day that in July, you would have never arrived that day and pulled the trigger?
I think, and even today, teens need to have that gap, that space of time occupied. Because I was fine when I was in school. You know, I was fine when I was in the YMCA. It's having all of this free time on your hands and your parents not really caring where you're at. It starts at home. Your parents need to raise their kids in a way that they don't have, that they don't restrict their freedom so much that they don't have a childhood, but that they do have a curfew to be home. My curfew to be home was at 11 o'clock at 13. And if I wasn't at home by 11 o'clock, she would lock me out as punishment and I couldn't get back in till the next morning. If you're locking a 13-year-old out of and giving them a curfew at 11 o'clock, that's a lot of leeway. That's a lot of rope to hang yourself with. So I just think I needed more structure, as well as kids today. We need structure and to fill that time up with things that are positive instead of negative.
Hmm. Yeah. I'm talking today with Ian Manuel. He's the author of a new memoir. It's called My Time Will Come, a memoir of crime, punishment, hope, and redemption. He committed a gun crime at the age of 13. He was sentenced at that time as a juvenile to life without the possibility of parole. He ended up serving 26 years and was released in 2016. 18 of those 26 years, as you heard a little earlier, were spent in solitary confinement. Now, Ian, you were, again, the original sentence was life without the possibility of parole, but you did get out in part because of a Supreme Court decision in 2010. Now, this decision is in the case of Graham v. Florida, and the court ruled that juveniles could not be sentenced to life in prison without parole for non-homicide crime. So I just want to play a moment here. This is Justice Anthony Kennedy in 2010 reading the majority opinion.
The limited culpability of juvenile non-homicide offenders and the severity of life without parole sentences all lead to the conclusion that the sentencing practice under consideration is cruel and unusual. The court now holds that for a juvenile offender who did not commit homicide, the Eighth Amendment forbids the sentence of life without parole. A state need not guarantee eventual freedom to juveniles convicted of non-homicide crimes, but it must give them some meaningful opportunity to obtain release based on demonstrated maturity and rehabilitation.
Justice Anthony Kennedy in 2010. So, Ian, how did that decision change your life?
Well, first of all, I think I need to let you know how I heard that decision. I'll never forget. It was May 17th, 2010, and I had a small transistor AM/FM radio that someone had snuck to me in solitary confinement. And I was listening to NPR, and I'll never forget, it came on and it said, in a 5-4 decision, the U.S. Supreme Court overturns juvenile life sentences. And we'll have more on this story in a minute. And I couldn't believe what I heard. And I screamed, it's over. It's over. And all the other inmates say, Ian, what are you screaming about? And I just couldn't even get the words out. But you know how NPR is. You have to wait an additional 30 minutes to hear the rest of it, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
And so because it came on at the top of the hour and 30 minutes passed and then they came back on and they changed it. They said it's a 6-3 decision because they were counting Justice Roberts' decision in the majority and he only ruled for Graham. And I was just so ecstatic. I couldn't believe it. I felt like I was going home. I'm like, it's over. It's over. Well, the judge in my case heard of the decision as well and immediately kind of brought me back to court for resentencing. And when we get back to court, the state of Florida had a surprise for all of us because they dropped the bombshell and said, we're not resentencing Mr. Manuel today because the state of Florida is appealing. We do not believe the Graham decision applies to Ian Manuel. Hmm. So the judge said, what? Why do you say that? Well, because Ian has a non-homicide. Ian Manuel is charged with attempted murder, which is falls under the homicide statute. So we don't believe it. And so they appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, which denied certiorari. And thank God I was taken back to be resentenced in 2011. I'll tell you what happens next.
Ian Manuel's new book is My Time Will Come. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we are talking with Ian Manuel. He's the author of the new memoir, My Time Will Come, a memoir of crime, punishment, hope, and redemption. And Ian, you were telling us about what happened next after the state of Florida said it was going to appeal your case and try to keep you in or prevent you from having essentially a resentencing hearing after that Supreme Court case came down. So what happened next?
Yeah, what happened next was the state of Florida appealed to the Florida Supreme Court saying that Graham v. Florida didn't apply to Ian Manuel because I had an attempted homicide, which falls under the homicide statute. The Florida Supreme Court refused to hear that foolishness. And so the state of Florida appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, asking them to accept the case that they had basically just ruled on. The U.S. Supreme Court denied certiorari to the state of Florida, and I was taken back to be resentenced in 2011, December, around Christmas time. And I'll never forget, the judge said something before he went into the chambers to deliberate about my new sentence that let me know I wasn't going home that day. He looked down at me and he said, the legislative intent in 1990 when Mr. Manuel committed this crime was to punish, not to rehabilitate. And he went in his chambers, he deliberated my sentence for about 30 minutes, and he came back out, and in place, he nullified my life sentences, struck them down, and in place gave me 65 years, followed by 10 years probation and 2 years community control. I had served around 22 years at that time, and I was crushed. I'll never forget riding back to the prison with tears rolling down my eyes, looking out of the window at Tampa, my hometown, get smaller and smaller with the Adele song, Someone Like You, resounding in my mind. Like, don't forget me. I'm just looking at Tampa get smaller and smaller. And I'm like, I'm going to be back. This is not, you have not heard the last of me. And thanks to Brian Stevenson and the Equal Justice Initiative, who took my case in 2006 and continued to fight for me, I did come back. Mm-hmm. And I came back better than ever. And this time, things changed and were different.
And released eventually in 2016. On the day that you got out, what was that like?
Can you imagine escaping a burning building? imagine escaping a burning building with your life after having your dream shattered for so many times. Every time, every window you try to go to, it's hot and you can't get through. But some type of way, by the grace of God, you escaped that burning building with your life. And that's how I felt out. It felt like I was so thankful to be alive. And we met up with Debbie, my victim in the case. And then I realized dreams come true because I had this fantasy in solitary confinement in the depths of my imagination that if I ever got to meet Debbie again face to face, I wouldn't shoot her. I would kiss her on both sides of her cheek. And that's exactly what I did. Then we went and had pizza downtown near the spot where the crime happened. And then I was on my way to Equal Justice Initiative reentry program where I learned to reenter society, like do things like cook, grocery shop, budget, try to learn how to drive a car, which I still don't know how to drive a car and I still don't know how to cook, but at least they tried to teach me.
Yeah. Well, we actually have Debbie Bagri's voice here in a clip from a video of her talking about her relationship with you. So here's Debbie.
I forgave him because he was a child. I used this to make my life better. I refocused.
Well, Ian, stand by here for just a second because I want to bring in Tammy Gregg into the conversation now. She's deputy director of the National Prison Project at the ACLU. Tammy Gregg, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Magna. Ian.
So
thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. We wanted to bring you into the conversation to sort of put Ian's story in the broader context of juvenile criminal justice in this country. First of all, today in 2021, how would you describe the extent to which juveniles can be incarcerated for long, long periods of time in this country?
Unfortunately, Meghna, it's not very different than the extent to which adults can be put in confinement and put in solitary confinement. Just to give you some facts and figures, the United States has 2.3 million incarcerated people presently. Certainly, we are only 5% of the worldwide population, but we're 20% of the world's incarcerated people. As for juveniles who are confined across the country, there are about 50% of that population in some sort of criminal justice involvement and confinement.
And regarding solitary, how many other countries outside the United States use solitary confinement on juveniles?
Solitary confinement on juveniles is often barred as a categorical exclusion in many other countries. The United States is unique in that it continues to incarcerate juveniles at very high rates. I will say that in 2018, Congress passed two laws that allowed juveniles who are confined on the federal level mm-hmm. to no longer be incarcerated except in extraordinary circumstances. And that certainly is a step forward. But for the most part, the problem still exists because juveniles are largely confined in state facilities, and those facilities are not obligated to follow the law. Solitary in a whole is a problem across our country, but there are states who are starting to look more closely at it and begin to make changes and successfully address the ills of solitary confinement, which are widespread, recognized as being inhumane, recognized as causing severe psychological problems and physiological problems, and actually not actually lowering the rates of crime and doing more injury when people are actually released from jails and prisons and correctional facilities and juvenile justice facilities.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about some of the reforms that have happened in just a second here. But,
sure.
But you know, Ian told us that when he was first incarcerated, they put him in solitary for his own protection because he was so little and so young in an adult population. So putting someone in solitary confinement as a means of protecting them, does that still happen in U.S. prisons?
It does. And I know it's hard to understand, but the law does require that juveniles or adolescents have sight and sound separation from adults in order to make them safe. It doesn't mean, however, that you have to put them in solitary confinement. As Ian described his circumstances, solitary doesn't, putting a child away from the general population or from adults does not mean you have to put them in a cell, a steel cell that has very little light coming in to it, that's the size of a parking lot, that has very little contact with other human beings, which is the main problem with solitary, is the isolation factor, which certainly does no good to the adolescent brain. Science shows you that they're already isolated, and it creates more anxiety, it creates more distress on their part, and anger. And so you're exacerbating the problems when you put a youth in solitary confinement conditions. And those kinds of things begin to happen before long-term solitary. We're talking as soon as 7 days in solitary confinement, there's brain activity that shows that your brain activity is depressed. So imagine multiplying that time over weeks or months, or unfortunately in Eden's case, over years. Mm-hmm. The horrible psychological effects are broadly exacerbated. So just to make sure I answered your initial question, though, yes, it still happens. Part of it happens because some facilities are trying to protect the youth. But there are ways that you can isolate people without putting them in solitary or restrictive housing conditions that limit their social interaction and their ability to congregate and their ability to breathe, frankly, and to have some contact with people.
Yeah. You know, in 1990, when Ian committed that crime, and then thereafter when he was tried and sentenced. In his story, you hear how the criminal justice system itself didn't care about all of those potential negative outcomes that you're talking about, Tammy, because as Ian told us several times in this hour, the judges told him the very purpose of the sentence to him as a juvenile was punishment and not rehabilitation.
Yes.
Exactly. And Meghna, I am an advocate, and I would be remiss if I didn't advocate for somebody that's still suffering under the conditions that I suffered under during my incarceration. And that person I want to advocate for is Dow D. Streeter, DC number 514-9888 in Florida State Prison, who has been languishing in solitary confinement for 24 years. I received a call from him last night telling me he had swallowed something that had his stomach about to bust because he was going crazy in solitary. And they had just recommended that his time in solitary be extended for an additional 6 months. After 24 years, they were still bringing up things that he had did in the 90s to keep him in solitary confinement. I wouldn't be doing my job as an advocate if I didn't let the world know that Florida has a long way to go, and they are still incarcerating people in solitary confinement for decades.
Mm. Well, that's Ian, I'm grateful that you brought that up, because the question I was going to ask Tammy is, how much has that underlying purpose of the sentence and the use of solitary with juveniles in particular changed the punishment, not rehabilitation? Have we made any advances on that?
Meghna, that's a great question. We have made strides in the juvenile confinement space as far as making sure that that initial punishment doesn't have to punish you for the rest of your life. A lot of changes happened during the Obama administration and the prior administrations to make sure that there was more rehabilitation as part of the treatment or the confinement, making sure that youth were getting access to educational opportunities, to rehabilitation activities, to congregate settings, being able to get treatment, frankly, cognitive behavioral treatment. And I'd say that change has happened in the last 8 to 10 years. And as you can see from the laws that passed that I mentioned in 2018, both the First Step Act and the Juvenile Justice Delinquency Prevention Act, which was reauthorized by Congress, they all demonstrate that societal attitudes are changing and legal attitudes are changing with respect to juveniles and solitary confinement. And there's a recognition that if we're going to expect people to come out and be law-abiding citizens, that we have to give them the tools to do that. Mm-hmm. And that certainly has been the mindset, I think, that has begun to happen. And more needs to be done, don't get me wrong. But it's definitely a very positive start in the last few years.
Okay, but positive starts with big U-turns, though, because just last month, the Supreme Court ruled again in a 6-3 ruling that juvenile offenders can still be sentenced to life without parole. Can you explain that a little, Tammy?
So I'm not as familiar with criminal law, I will say that. But I can say in general, you're right. I mean, you're right. It takes the Senate, the Congress to change the law. It takes courts to change the law. And as I mentioned earlier, states have no uniform standards that require them not to hold juveniles to those high standards. It's a mindset that has been in effect since the late 70s. Prior to the 70s, as you know, rehabilitation was a model. It wasn't always reached, obviously, for its intended purposes, but that was the model of the penal system. After the 70s, and I'd say well into the 80s and 90s, they turned to a tough on policymakers, turned to a tough on crime, tough on drugs sort of mentality that the paradigm was about punishment for your crime. And then in the case of solitary confinement, when you're already confined, creating a jail within the jail for further punishment. And so that attitude is going to take a U-turn, just like you said, to shift. It's going to take a U-turn from policymakers. It's going to take a U-turn from lawmakers. And it's going to take a U-turn from the public, frankly, recognizing there's much more harm than good in such punitive treatment of people, and particularly juveniles.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've seen at the state level that a couple of dozen states have banned or severely curtailed life without parole for juveniles. Again, that Supreme Court decision, though, from just last month, issued a ruling that life without parole can be issued for teenagers. So there's a lot going on at both the state and federal level here. But it does seem as if the very fact that there's a lot going on is quite different than it was in 1990 and 91 when you were first incarcerated. We could talk for hours more, and this hour has just flown by. I've just got a minute or so left here, Ian, and I want to ask you. You have so much to tell, but as a last thought, what do you want people to take away from your story? What do you want them to learn?
My mantra is the impossible is obtainable. And I will repeat that to myself in solitary confinement. I want people to take away from this that the will of the human spirit is inconquerable. That if you can believe in yourself, anything is possible, man. And I want people to fight with me. Come join hands with me in this fight to end juvenile solitary confinement, to change the way juveniles are treated in this country, to change the way people are kept in solitary confinement. There needs to be a cap. There needs to be a cap placed on the length. My friend Darryl Streeter should not be placed in solitary confinement for 24 years. Demetrius McCutcheon shouldn't be there for 25 years. My friend Michael McKinney shouldn't be there for 25 years. It doesn't take that long to see that a human being has been broken and is ready for a release. Thank you for your time, Magnum.
Well, Ian Manuel's book is My Time Will Come, a memoir of crime, punishment, hope, and redemption. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Ian, thank you so much for sharing your story.
And thank you for having me.
And Tammy Gregg, Deputy Director of the National Prison Project at the ACLU, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.